The November 2020 election will be the most important this country has seen in decades. Our current administration is attempting to derail it. How? By politicizing the U.S. Postal Service and by doing everything they can to discredit mail-in voting.
It's the biggest risk we have. The mail-in ballots, they mail them to anybody.
The ramifications of this will have a ripple effect throughout the country. On today's podcast, we will discuss vote by mail and why it is needed more than ever during this year's election. Welcome to the War Room at American Bridge podcast. I'm David Brock, co-founder of American Bridge 21st Century. On this episode, we are looking to dive into one of the biggest issues surrounding this year's election, mail-in voting. With me today is my guest, Governor Deval Patrick. Governor Patrick is the former governor of Massachusetts, presidential candidate, and co-chair of American Bridge. Welcome to the program, Governor.
David, thank you so much for the generous introduction. It's great to be with you.
I thought we would start by explaining a little bit to our audience about the function that American Bridge provides on the Democratic side and your decision to get involved with us this cycle, which we're all very happy about.
Thank you, David. It's been an honor and enlightening to be involved. American Bridge is a part of a broad mosaic that answers a need, I think, in our politics, that we talk to everybody, the people who agree with us, the people who don't, the people who always vote Democratic, the folks who never do, and the folks who sometimes do, and the folks who don't vote at all. And through the campaign and various other initiatives, folks are targeting different parts of the electorate to make the case about what it is Democrats bring in the interest of the long-term benefit of American citizens. What I love about American Bridge is that with a lot of very smart use of data and analytics, American Bridge has targeted some 80 counties in three swing states, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Michigan, where there is a concentration of Obama-Trump voters, meaning people who voted once or twice for Obama, and then in 2016 for President Trump, then candidate Trump. And doing it in a way that isn't about shaming anybody, but creating a permission structure so that folks in their own voices and in their own and through their own thoughts find their way out of the trance of Donald Trump and are open to and indeed ultimately supportive of Joe Biden.
Well, trance is a great way of putting it. And that will give me a segue into our subject for today. We saw in the past day or so, Donald Trump encouraging apparently people to try to vote twice. We saw other headlines about Russian disinformation about mail-in voting. So let me ask you this to start. There's a kind of nightmare scenario circulating around, certainly in Democratic circles, about what someone's called the Red Mirage. And what this has to do with is Trump seemingly ahead, let's say, on election night and prematurely declaring victory, but all the votes not counted, favoring Joe Biden, lawsuits flying, chaos ensuing. So what do you think the likelihood of that kind of thing unraveling happening? And is there something Democrats should be preparing for now to kind of prevent a nightmare scenario?
Well, I think we should probably prepare ourselves intellectually as well as legally and practically for every sort of scenario, because frankly, well before Donald Trump, the long history of the Republican Party, at least at the national level, has been to undermine the vote. I'll leave aside some of the shenanigans of since before 1965 and the Voting Rights Act, but recent efforts to make registration harder, more cumbersome, the purging laws where registered voters are removed from the voting rolls, in some cases for not participating more often. We've seen the reintroduction of poll taxes, most notably in Florida, where the franchise was restored by popular vote to former felons. And then the Republican governor and Republican legislature decided to condition that on paying fees and fines that in practical terms, for many, many people could never be paid. And then, you know, you add to that the hyperpartisan gerrymandering, the effort, much of it successful, to make, limitless, money a part of our politics. And more, I am left with the impression that Republicans don't think they could win a fair fight. And here comes Donald Trump, a person, of, habitual, lawlessness, and a willingness to cheat, who is trying to undermine, mail-in, voting, which, at a time of a public health crisis is certainly something, that an awful lot of people are considering, maybe more than usual.
Well, I think, the point that, Donald Trump is, in his attack on mail-in voting is really symptomatic of what you said has been going on, at least for the last decade in Republican circles, to try to get everybody to obstruct the vote as much as possible through a lot of different laws that they've passed. And you brought up gerrymandering, and I want to get into that a little bit, because after the sort of red wave of outside spending, as you referred to, in 2010, we saw that Republicans redrew electoral maps. And one of the first things they did was to try to pass all these laws, voter ID requirements, limits on early voting, purging the voter rolls, closing polling places in minority neighborhoods. And there were more than a couple dozen specific laws that were enacted in mostly Republican states during that period. So it seems to me that, you know, Democrats have all those barriers to deal with, as well as the mail-in vote. And as much as we have our eye on Joe Biden and our federal elections, that we shouldn't take our eye off state elections in 2020, because this will be an opportunity to undo some of these really onerous and terrible laws that the Republicans put into place.
Really, really important points all around that we have to pay attention, not just to the top of the ballot. And I'm enthusiastic about the Biden-Harris ticket, but to the Senate, to the Congress, to state and local races, where many of these onerous and burdensome voting rules have been put in place. And I will say, David, if I may, this effort goes back a lot more than just the last 10 years. My first encounter with Jeff Sessions was when he was U.S. Attorney in Alabama. And he brought an indictment with the help of the Reagan Justice Department against three longtime African-American voting advocates in Alabama who had helped old rural black voters file absentee ballots. And by the way, the First Amendment protects that help, as does statutes. But they tried to intimidate those voters when those voters had the first opportunity ever to elect a black office holder to countywide to a countywide seat. And I helped defend those three. We call them the Perry County Three. We won acquittals on all counts. But that strategy was all about intimidating voters from participating. So I think what I'm hoping your listeners, our listeners, will take away from this conversation is, number one, that voting by mail is not new. It's available in most states. In Western states, it's been universally used for a long while. In many states, you can file an absentee ballot without a special excuse. Just, you know, it's inconvenient for you. In some states, you have to have an excuse. And in some of those states, the laws are being changed so that your fear of contracting the virus is a valid excuse. What I advise folks to do if they are going to vote by mail is to get their ballot and return it well before the deadline. Because I hope we get to talk about the intentional interference with the post office. That is a problem. And then in some places there are, you know, there's secure, drop-off, boxes for those ballots as well. And yes, we should count every ballot, even if, authorities can't get all of those ballots counted on election day itself. And we should be prepared for that.
Well, I think that's really great advice. Let's talk a little bit about what we're going to hear from the other side, though. We're going to hear allegations of widespread voter fraud.
Mail-in voting, it's going to be the greatest fraud in the history of elections.
And this is, as near as I can tell, a canard and a concoction by a kind of infrastructure that the right wing has created around this issue. There's such a thing as anti-voting rights conservatives, if you can imagine that, that there really is a subset of the conservative movement. And this is centered in places like the Heritage Foundation and Fox News. And they have an Honest Election Project, which has got one of those Orwellian names attached to it. Is this an instance of projection on the part of the Republicans? How can these false allegations be countered when, you know, you take their own data, you look at the Heritage Foundation data, and it doesn't even show, it shows 0.007% of instances of fraud. So their own data doesn't even show it. And yet we're going to be up against this noise machine. And I'm concerned about that. Are you?
Well, I am concerned about that. And I think that is also a part of the strategy, just as using language so that it means the opposite, you know, so that its use is the opposite of its meaning, like an honest election strategy, as you say, and constantly casting doubt on mail-in balloting or on this election, as President Trump is doing right now, is a part of the strategy. And folks need to keep their eye on the prize, as the old folks used to say. As you said, fraud in elections in America is remarkably low, in fact, nearly non-existent. When it is detected, or when it is supposed, it's often an honest mistake, but even that number doesn't rise to the level of what can influence or has influenced outcomes in the past. But you understand that we're being set up, folks are being set up in some states, you know, like the exact match rule in Georgia, where the signature on your absentee or mail-in ballot has to match exactly the signature on your registration application. And God love you if that happens. But how would you know if you didn't have access to both documents at the same time? Look, we just had a primary race here in Massachusetts. We had record participation in a Democratic primary. Something like 60 or 70% of that vote were mail-in ballots. And the count was done in a timely way. We had a decision in almost all of the races on election night because they started counting before the election day. They were authorized to do that. No evidence of fraud, no evidence of games being played.
Let me go back to something you said a little earlier and probe a little deeper on the question of why this is all going. The question of, you know, do they think that they can't win otherwise, that they can't win a fair fight? How much of this is about demographic changes in America? I mean, I think that you're absolutely right that there's a long and terrible history of this. But in more recent times, I think the Obama coalition really scared the conservatives and some of these restrictive voting requirements that were put in 2011 and 2012 were a reaction to Obama, and the Tea Party had a group called True the Vote, which was really just an effort to intimidate people at the ballot box. So what's underneath this as far as their fears?
Well, you know, I have to hand it to leader Mitch McConnell, who I think shocked so many of us when he said, I think even before Obama's first inauguration, that the number one objective of the Republican Party was to make Obama a one-term president. This, by the way, in the midst of a global financial collapse. And, you know, so many of us were shocked. And I think in many respects, he understood the seriousness and significance of what had happened better than many did. and it goes to the premise of your question. There was overwhelming bipartisan and nonpartisan support for hopeful, forward-looking, inclusive politics that was on offer by Barack Obama. And they realized they had to shut that down. So all kinds of things, for example, all kinds of issues where the party had once been in support suddenly became, including healthcare, suddenly became wrong when they were, when Obama was on the other side of them. And I think if you look at, you know, if the polling is to be believed, overwhelming majorities of Americans want a woman, her doctor, her family, and her conscience to make the decisions about her own healthcare choices, want reasonable, effective measures to assure gun safety, want fair and free access to the ballot for all citizens, want comprehensive immigration reform that includes a path to citizenship for people who are here and have been here and contributing for a long time, want a tax system which is transparent and simple, and where everyone contributes according to his or her means. We don't get these things because, you know, we don't have the weight of the argument on our side. We don't get these things because the system is gamed so that we don't get these things. And the subjects we're talking about is a part of that strategy.
Right. Absolutely. Gerrymandering and all of it. Since 1982, I'm sure you know, there's been a ban on Republican Party, what they call vote fraud operations, after courts found that what the Republicans were doing were intimidating and excluding minority voters. But there was a court decision in 2018 that lifted the ban on that. And so for the first time in four decades, we're going to see a Republican operation where they can mount these kinds of intimidation programs. And the RNC has said, you know, it's raising tens of millions of dollars to send 50,000 volunteers in 15 states to monitor polling places. So this is something we won't have seen in a while. And I'm wondering, you know, can the intent of this be anything other than to cast doubt on the legitimacy of the election?
Well, of course, that's right. Look, we have done America has done vote monitoring in any number of developing countries around the world where it was advised, usually by the United Nations, that come in and keep an eye on the integrity of the vote. And monitoring sounds like such a benign, sort of innocuous term. But when that turns to intimidation, which it has, then it's counterproductive. It isn't actually in support of democracy. It's in support of power and holding on to that power. So I think this is just, as I say, this is one of these moments when so much of the Republican agenda, and I say this, by the way, David, as a loyal Democrat, but not one who feels you have to hate Republicans to be a good Democrat. I say this as a patriot, first and foremost. A believer in democracy and a willingness to use persuasion and the weight of the argument in full contest. And I think what we have is a party that has decided power, not principle, is the thing. And so I think this is one of these. I've said more and more. More often than probably you care to hear, because you've heard me say it. If the character of the candidates is always an issue, this time it's the character of the country. That's what's at stake this time. What kind of country do we want? What kind of country are we? And I think that means that every voter needs to dig deep and look past and work around all of the obstacles that are being laid in front, needs to have a plan and execute on that plan to vote early as possible, to assure that vote is lodged, needs to insist that the vote is counted, and that we not declare a winner until the votes are counted, because I am confident that we have the right people and the right message and the right direction to enable a better, more just, and more prosperous America for everyone, everywhere, regardless of party.
Well, yeah, I couldn't agree with you more that this should not be a partisan issue.
The rest of your accusations are actually...
Will you put the high-speed machines back?
No, I will not.
You will not?
Will not.
You will not. Well, there you go.
But unfortunately, these voter suppression efforts, they have a partisan impact, and I wanted to... This doesn't get talked about all that much, but I did want to probe a little bit on this, because I think it's important for people to realize that there's an effect on the outcome as a result of these restrictions. And multiple academic studies and court rulings have indicated that these racially biased election laws in 2016 favored the Republicans. And if you look at a place like Wisconsin, you know, we had a governor there, Scott Walker, who tried to turn the state into kind of a laboratory for destroying the Democratic Party and democracy itself with these voter ID requirements. And what we saw was a suppression of the black vote, which dropped 19%, which was four times the national decline. So let's talk a little bit about energizing the black vote. Obviously, Biden is going to have to do better than Hillary did in this respect.
However it's happened, America's ready, in John's words, to lay down, quote, the heavy burden of hate at last, and to end the hard work of rooting out our systemic racism.
What do you suggest his approach be in relation to this?
Well, he's done a lot of great things, Joe Biden has, already in terms of the policy agenda for job and wealth creation in black and brown communities. He's done a lot to acknowledge structural racism. He's talked about and made some proposals around reforming the criminal justice system, including policing and sentencing. All of that is critical. And I think he's also, and Kamala Harris as well, has made it plain that the agenda of the of a would-be Biden-Harris administration is not all segmented by demographics. It is how we lift us all, how we make economic mobility and real justice available to everybody. Because the fact of the matter is that the economic insecurity, the social isolation, the feeling that you know the measures of depression and anxiety or hopelessness, and the sense that these issues become issues at election time and disappear in between elections, that has been the lived experience of many American voters who are black for generations. Right now, everybody's feeling that. So the opportunity presented by that that intersection is to bring a sense of urgency for everyone. That's the first point I want to make. But secondly, I think Joe Biden understands and Kamala Harris understands that for many black voters, showing up and voting is just the start. That the administration then, working with the Senate and the House, with the business community, with advocates on the ground, with partners of every kind, have to deliver. So the skepticism that some black voters have about promises made and promises not kept is what the Trump administration keeps kind of, you know, rubbing on. And I think it is another reason why we as Democrats need to overwhelm the polls in November and win by a very, very wide and decisive margin, and then stay engaged to assure that the new administration, the new Senate, the new House actually deliver on the expectations of all of us.
Well, I think your point that we really need to have a big margin here is one that a lot of people are talking about. That would mean possibly putting some states in play that are not typically in our column, places like Arizona, maybe even a Georgia. Obviously, Bridge is focused on the key Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania that you mentioned. But where do you think we are? If we're going to put together this kind of this big margin, then we've got to concentrate. We've got to have groups that are working in across all these different coalitions and building and working in different states, not just the three sort of firewall blue states. So what can you say about what do we need to do to get the highest turnout we can get?
First of all, in my view, we have to talk to our base and we have to expand our base. We can't count them without asking them. And I think that has had that has happened in the past. And people know when they're taken for granted, and they sometimes react to that by not showing up. That's not helpful. We have to talk to everybody, all of our base, wherever they are. By the way, including in those so-called battleground states. So not just the swing voters in those states, but to our base in those states. And then I think taking the fight to places where, because of changes in demographics that include race, national origin, and age, there is folks may be more open to a Democratic case than they have been in the past. And you mentioned some of them. Arizona, we saw in Georgia with Stacey Abrams' race that her work engaging everyone everywhere brought her, subject to, but for the cheating at the end, she'd be the governor today. And we've got two great statewide candidates there for Senate who I think are very competitive, and a number of House members as well on the Democratic side. In the midterms, David, I was working in Texas and in Mississippi as well. There are numbers of really marvelous grassroots organizing groups statewide, loosely connected to each other. Interestingly, to me, often working outside the party structure. That's a whole other subject. But working really hard to advance Democratic candidates. And I think, we've got a couple statewide races there that don't always get attention and money, but they ought to. And it's an investment over time, so they're moving in our direction. I'm very excited about North Carolina and South Carolina, even this time around. But it's to the point: you don't win if you don't compete, if you don't show up and make the argument, not as an argument for why a party should win, but why our candidates and our vision is the best one for your neighbors and the best one for America.
Well, if our goal is the big tent and to turn out as much of our vote across the board, whether that's in minority communities, in the suburbs, suburban college-educated women, or the bridge focus on the non-college-educated whites in these rural areas, it strikes me that Trump's strategy is kind of the opposite, which is narrow casting, and that he's really at this point, there's a little bit of a whiff of desperation in the way I see it, that all he really can do is try to find more like-minded voters, possibly voters who didn't vote for him in 16, but are of the MAGA persuasion. And that's why he's doubling down. And that's why we see not only the assault on the mail-in vote, but the general chaos that he's creating. And it seems that there is a segment of the voting population that kind of likes the chaos and likes him. And we Democrats have to admit that exists, and that there's kind of a method to the madness. So what do you think about Trump's strategy, not only on the mail-in voting, but a little more broadly?
Well, you know, for someone as undisciplined in his thinking as the president seems to be, certainly as president and even before, I'm not certain there is a strategy. There's a lot of behavior. Right. And if he wins, you know, folks will invent a strategy to explain what happened. But it's more impulsive and it's more self-indulgent. And as I say, at a time when what we need is leadership and healing, I think it is more and more apparent to people that he's the wrong guy and Joe Biden is the right one. I think that the you know, he's entertaining for some. And I will say this, David, the one truth that candidate Trump spoke in 2016, in my view, is that is when he said that conventional or establishment politics wasn't working well enough for a lot of people. By the way, it's the same truth candidate Trump and outgoing President Obama, candidate Obama and outgoing President Obama talked about. It's the same thing Bernie Sanders talked about. And it is true for a lot of people. Now, there was nothing about Trump's, there has been nothing about Trump's performance in office that actually speaks to those unmet needs, that actually addresses those unmet needs, that shows any discipline about trying to solve those kinds of problems in people's lives. But that rhetorical truth was just that in 2016. Now we have a record and we can see how little, how unconcerned he is about us. You know, we have how many hundreds of thousands of deaths from COVID-19, 6 million infections. We have been revealed as having a broken healthcare system, a fragile economy, and our relationships and esteem around the world, which, by the way, have never depended alone on the strength of our military or the size of our treasury. They have depended on the fealty, the allegiance to our civic values of equality, opportunity, and fair play. And that's in tatters in this administration. So I think we have a really strong case to make. I think his case is weak, but he thrives on chaos. And you know, for folks who are overwhelmed by chaos or the enormity of this of this moment, you know, they may seize up. I'm hoping they won't, and they will find in Joe Biden a kind of calming presence, and in the chaos itself, frankly, a reason to show up and to vote Democrat.
Well, I take your point that there may be no grand strategy, but there are tactics. So let's kind of wrap up on one tactic that may be afoot that you mentioned earlier, which is the politicization of the post office.
So where is Nancy Pelosi? She and her Democrat colleagues will be back in Washington soon to pursue their latest manufactured crisis, the Postal Service.
You know, they really loaded a lot of major Republican donors onto that board, including DeJoy, who runs it, but other members of that board. And they've made some policy changes that look suspect, at least from the outside. I know we've got some vigorous congressional oversight trying to investigate this and try to figure out what's really going on. What's your sense of that? And will the post office, you know, can it get the job done? And is the will there to get the job done? Or are there some bad actors there?
Well, I think the rank and file at the post office probably have the will to get it done. There are... you know, there's a funny way this administration has of trying to undermine some norm or institution, being called out on it, And then saying, oh, I see. Well, we're going to slow that down. But then they don't. You remember that absolutely horrific separating of children from their refugee parents at the southern border shocked everyone. And the administration was called on the carpet after denying that they were doing it. They said, we're going to stop doing it. They're doing it today. Our attention has moved on to other things. You'd think if they were serious, if DeJoy was serious about his comment in one of the hearings recently that, you know, the vote is sacred and we're going to do what we need to do, that he would not just pledge to suspend further reforms, but they would roll it all back to make sure that the mail service was functioning as efficiently as possible through the election. And then if he wins, he can start over. If he loses and he wants to try to get stuff during the transition, he can start over. But there isn't a seriousness about trying to assure that the service does what it can, which is the reason I say, and just to repeat, if folks are planning to use mail-in ballots to get them as early as they are available and get them back in the mail well in advance. Voting starts in America in a couple of states, I think, in next week. And so there's early voting up to that. There are many states where there are ballot drop-off, secure boxes where you receive your mail-in ballot, but you don't have to send it back through the post office. You can drop it in one of these boxes in a secure way. We did that in Massachusetts. I encourage other states to, and I encourage voters to use those as well. If you can use a service where you can track your ballot, that's a little more expensive than regular mail, but if you can afford that and you have to use the mail, I would advise people to do that so that they can demonstrate that their ballot got to where it was supposed to get in the time it was supposed to get there. And then again, I would say if people do have to vote in person, and many will choose to do so, prepare for that too. You know, if there are going to be long lines, bring a chair, bring a book, bring some music to listen to, bring your mask to be sure, and make the time, because this is, as you said at the outset, the most consequential election of a long, long time.
That's a perfect piece of advice for our folks who are listening. And thank you for your time today. It's very illuminating on what's really one of the most important issues we're facing in these next few weeks.
On to victory and a better democracy for all of us.
Will you commit to providing this committee with the data that you say you're already formally collecting, disaggregated by congressional district, on COVID-19 related deaths, positive tests, and quarantines of postal workers by Friday, since this is quite literally a matter of life and death?
For more information on voting by mail, please check out AmericanBridgePact.org. Check back for more podcasts and information about the upcoming election and how we plan to hold the Republicans accountable. Until next time, I'm David Brock. Thanks for listening to The War Room at American Bridge.